So welcome everybody to the ongoing meditation classes. For those who've come for the introduction to meditation class, that is being held in the room to my right. This is the class, the ongoing class. I say there's a difference. If you just want to learn the basics of meditation, that is in the room to my right, a four-week course. And this is the ongoing class. In this ongoing class, we meditate a bit longer, usually 40 to 45 minutes. And the continuous class here, and the, beginner's class, but the introduction class is in the room on my right. Got that out of the way. Now, the next thing, even though it's a Saturday today, you know, many of you may have been working this morning, and of course, I am one of those. And it's important to be able to learn in meditation. Doesn't matter how busy you've been or what you've been talking about beforehand, to learn how to let that past go. Even if there's unfinished business which you have to bring up afterwards, nevertheless, if you want to have a calm, peaceful, energized mind which can still have some clarity, we have to learn how to let go of the past. And sometimes, you know, people have been talking about that a long time. It was part of Buddhist teachings from the very, very beginning. But still, when Eckhart Tolle came along and wrote a bestseller, still that made his present moment awareness idea even just more popular. And it sounds really good. We all know how important it is to let go of the past. But how do you do it? Can you just suddenly sit here, and doesn't matter what happened a few moments ago, can you actually just put it down, put it away, file it away? Or if it's not really that important, can you really put it in the bin? It's not really important. Why is it that we keep on focusing on things which are not going to be, we can't really serve the purpose of finding solutions? No, we can't sort of undo that past. How can we solve that problem of freeing our mind, making it lighter and without so many obstacles we're always trying to carry? And I've said many times before, using some of those great similes which Ajahn Chah used to say, that to be like this is, I'm really grateful that someone as wise as Ajahn Chah could make these similes. They're amusing, but they work, and also it's very easy to teach others. He told me that when I become a more senior Buddhist monk, then I would have to be like a counselor. People will come and tell me all sorts of problems, not just personal problems, but big problems about management, about a life. How do you do that? Because sometimes you get so many really important problems, it could fill up your brain and you have nothing else you can do. So what you decide to do is to be a dustbin. And of course, if any one of you are in any position of being a counselor, being a good friend, dealing with people with difficulties, to be the counselor means that you have to listen to so many problems which are not yours. I always remember that. Why it was, I thought, that I was a Buddhist monk, a celibate. Why did I have to listen to people's marriage problems? Number one, what do I know about marriage? I've never been married. Or the problems in the office at work. I don't work for a corporation. And if I do, I'm actually the boss anyway. So what do I know about being oppressed by bad bosses? So no, all those things I think, what do I know? Sometimes I think it's probably the case you're not so involved either in the relationships of marriage, looking after children, or things like that. You don't know that area of life. which does mean you can get a much more detached perspective. In other words, you don't have to have cancer to be a oncologist, someone who knows how to treat cancer. But nevertheless, there's so many things which I get up to these days. But when it's time to go and teach a meditation class, always remember, be the dustbin. People want to come and talk to you, receive as much as you can. But once you've received it, always remember to be the dustbin with the hole in the bottom. So you keep nothing. Why do we have to keep things, thinking about them, trying to find solutions, thinking and still keep searching for something when it's not the time to do that? We can let things go. Being a dustbin with a hole in the bottom is the way we can get some freedom. So once we can do that, we're learning a little bit how to let the past go. And the other way, which I've often emphasized, is like sometimes reason and logic is not good enough. It sounds good enough. I've given many sort of similes, like, you know, your kids are doing an exam at school. And when they're doing their exam at school, they've done the first exam. Why do they, when they finish their first exam, start worrying about it? Did I do the question right? Did I do the question wrong? The exam's finished. Good or bad, it's over. Why can't we let it go? Or you know, somebody bangs the door when they're coming in. And if they bang the door when they're coming in, I mentioned this before, doesn't matter how many times you ask them to come in on time, nevertheless, if they bang the door, it goes pretty quickly. Bang and it's over. However, some people, they bang the door, and what happens next? Who was it who banged the door? We have to have quieter doors in this place. Maybe we could have those like in those big hotels, those circular doors go round and round and round, so the door never needs to bang. And that would also keep the noise from the outside down. You know, seen those circular doors? Round spinning doors? That'd be quite a good idea, wouldn't it? I wonder how much they cost. Has anybody done this before? And you can see the noise of the banging door disappeared a long time ago. But the thinking about it, the reactions to it, that is where the real noise is. Why can't we just let these things go? And if we could let those things go, our life would be so much sweeter and more free and more easy. Which is one of the reasons why that those of you who have come and listened to these teachings here many, many times know that an important part of the Buddha's teachings is not just the stillness, not just the letting go, but the kindness. And I think that our modern world does not realize the power of that kindness and how deep that kindness can be and how effective. So I've often said that if you want to let go of the past, be kind to it. Be kind to it first. It kind of softens it. In order to be kind to the past, who said what, who did what, sometimes when we make judgments, that's very harsh. And we do make judgments before we start meditating. And this is one of our problems. If we have kindness, real kindness, try and look at the mitigating facts. Don't ever try to be accusative of somebody and be a judge and a jury and say you're wrong. But have that ability to be soft and kind. Well, I don't know why you did that. But nevertheless, whatever you did, that's fine. It's not that bad. And if you have that softness, that kindness towards your past, then of course it's much easier to let it go. That's just a few minutes ago. hours ago, weeks ago, years ago. If you are going to judge, please judge with softness, with kindness. You don't really know why a person did that. Sometimes it's hard for me to know why I spoke that or I did that. Do you really know yourself so well that you can even judge yourself? So we can't really judge others either. We can't judge the past. The only thing we can do is let it go. And when we're kind to the past and all those actors in the past, all those people who contributed to that past, if we can be kind to every one of them, and kind even to the people who made the doors, when we have that type of kindness, then we can let things go so easily. And it's the same with our future. If we can only be kind to our future, even now, I don't know what it is about this modern age, I mean the last 6 months, but people have got so much fear. Someone was asking me this morning, they just wanted to go over to London to New York and do some studies at a good university, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, what if there's a nuclear war in New York? Well, it could happen, but really unlikely. Could have a nuclear war here, I don't know. But anyway, that fear, that negativity, that is what causes that anxiety, which means a pleasant trip overseas becomes a trip of fear and anxiety. Why on earth can't we just be kind to the future? And that kind to all the actors in the future. And when we're kind to them, then it's much easier to let those fears of the future disappear. And once they disappear, then it's easier to be in this present moment. But how many of you manage to get into a present moment awareness and you taste it, touch it, and it feels really good, it feels so free? Like you've been having to carry all these heavy burdens for such a long time, and now we can actually let them go. But the problem is that if we can learn how to be more kind to the present moment, then the present moment becomes more acceptable, easier to stay with. Have you ever noticed if there is like a cat or a dog, someone around? You know, sometimes how we can be kind to them. And when we have kindness, then we find the problems get so much more lighter. I don't know if you actually, you know, those of you who have cats, who have husbands, wives, children. It's amazing when you have the kindness, more kindness towards them, the problems get less. Even just wild animals, birds. Sometimes, have you ever had those birds who get stuck in the ceiling place of your buildings? And of course, sometimes people try and let them be free, open windows, or try and catch them. Catch them makes them far more afraid. One of the nicest things, if there is a bird, you know, caught, say in this roof here, if you can give lots and lots of kindness so the bird doesn't feel afraid, then the bird will quite simply eventually find the open window and fly out to its friends and to its idea of freedom. It's the same with us. How do we let go of things when it's caught in our mind, like a bird caught in the ceiling space, trying to find a way out? If you try and force it out, you try and trap it with a net. Sometimes that causes even injury to that little bird. But if you can be very soft and quiet, make that bird feel safe. And then open a window. Then you find the bird will, by itself, find its way out with far less problems. So this is actually how we deal with the present moment, any difficulties which we have. Kind to it, and then it disappears. Which means the present moment becomes much more beautiful and peaceful. And that's one of the main points of this little introduction. The kindness in this moment, as well as the past and the future, means the past and future disappears. And the present moment feels much more valuable, more delightful, more attractive. And your mind automatically wants to stay there. It's not what you do. You don't decide this. It becomes an automatic process, a conditioning to want to be here, to want to be quiet, to want to be silent. So that's just a brief introduction. So now, if you haven't already got into a good meditation posture, please adjust your legs or whatever. And it's nice again to see, if those of you haven't tried these little stools, I did ask this last time, can you hold up the stool? These are really comfortable things to sit on if you get sore knees or sore backs. There's another one over there. But you can see how they're used, and they're very, very comfortable. I was quite surprised that not many more people use them. You can use, obviously, the chairs, but they are also very, very comfortable. Very good. So, close your eyes. And with your eyes closed, become aware of your body. Many of you know how to do this. If you don't know how to do it, you just ask your body, how are you? Same as when I see one of you, ask how you are. Haven't seen you since last week. How are you? Makes that connection, you're mindful of that part of what you're looking at called its comfort. And this is an example, when I did that to my own body, I've been busy sort of talking and also couple of other things while we started this meditation. I never noticed just how my right toe was squashed under my left knee. Now I noticed it, I could adjust my posture. These fine adjustments before I really begin the meditation. And I do this because mindfulness is not enough. We need the kindness as well. You all know I call that kindfulness. I'm kind enough to my body to make sure it's relaxed, relaxed and comfortable. I ask my feet how they feel. Get to know them. And when the goal is trying to release any tightness or tension, that's what I'm looking for. Once I can spot something, it's pretty easy to find means, methods, by trial and error, to release any tightness. So my feet feel almost perfectly at ease. But I don't rush it. It's like sustained attention. Give it as much time as it needs. Then I move up, you know, from my feet to my lower legs. If there's any area which is sensitive, such as your ankles, just make sure that everything is in a good position. Even use the power of imagination. If any part of my body feels tense or aching, I often imagine like soaking it in a hot tub of water. So it all feels at ease. The imagination and reality in meditation can soon come together. It is real. You're relaxed. And you can sweep that attention up your body. I'm sweeping it up my lower legs to my knees. I can feel the muscles of my calves. I spent a long time in the beginning on my feet, but now my awareness has got stronger and I can feel these muscles so much more easily. It's like my awareness has grown in its amplitude, like the lights have been turned up in their intensity. And go past my knees. And my job is not to keep them stiff, but to release any blockages. To imagine things flowing through those knees with ease. Not holding anything back, not pushing anything through fast. Everything which we recognize as means of relaxation, comfort, health, and pass the knees to the thighs. So go past the thighs and go to the butt. And I do pause at the buttocks. Maybe just me, but if I don't get them right at the beginning, they can be quite painful and disturbing. If you get them right, you can meditate for long periods of time. I'm never ashamed to actually just to adjust if I need to. And I look at my waist. And I always like, as I often say, to stretch my back at this point. From there, I find the optimum position, the best position for my back. At that point, once I find it, it's easy to maintain for the rest of the meditation period. And then I scan the awareness up my body. Sometimes I scan it up my back first, but today I'm going to scan it just up the whole torso. Feel any blockages anywhere. So I go up the digestive tract. As I'm scanning upwards, I just check, is there any feelings in the places where those organs are? I sometimes say my back, you know, things like liver, spleen, kidneys. And as I go past them, often get them confused which one is which. If I feel there's any sort of tightness there, just imagine that tightness expanding, loosening, becoming more free. So everything begins to feel way more comfortable than when I started. I go up to my stomach and feel it. Over the weeks, months, years, you become way more sensitive to your body. When you're more aware of it, it's easier to care for it. You soon find out ways of relaxing your stomach. And you feel it becomes more relaxed, more at ease. You keep going up to your lungs. And again, with a huge amount of gratitude to my lungs. Keeps the air flowing. Keeps all the waste products going out. Sometimes I think of my lungs as how they connect me with nature. How the carbon dioxide is the food for much of what is green. And I breathe in the air, the oxygen. It helps me feel more at ease. And then get to my heart region. Just make sure there's no tightness there. No ache. Everything is relaxed and peaceful. I don't just react to my body. I am proactive. Look after it before anything happens. Till I get up to the top of my torso, to the shoulders. And surprise, surprise, that my shoulders are quite relaxed today. So I try and relax them even more. Just loosen any tightness anywhere. I'm not holding my body like I'm a model or something to be photographed, all tight and tense, filling somebody else's requirements. My body, it decides how it wants to sit, what's comfortable for it. So I let my arms become really loose, and the awareness goes down the arms, past the arm, the elbows. Even my elbows, I hardly have any trouble with them. I don't play sport. But nevertheless, today I'm just giving them an extra boost of kindness. An extra boost of this amazing attitude which loosens things. Which makes even the elbows feel that they've got a special cushion, one for each. Soft. They don't need to hold anything tightly or support anything. They can just sink into this beautiful satin cotton cushion. And down the arms to my hands. And here that I ask my hands, how are you? And they do need adjusting, so I adjust them. What's most comfortable for you right now? And that becomes the decider of my posture. What my body feels is most comfortable. I go back up to my shoulders and neck, making sure the head is well balanced on top of the neck. Going to the head, this scanning of attention. When I get to my face, that seems to be where much of the sensitivity is. Around the muscles, around the eyes, the nose and the mouth. Sometimes a little on the forehead. Just describing what I'm feeling. And I acknowledge those sensations and learn how to relax them all. Make them feel peaceful and easy. You soon learn how to do that. You know it's relaxation. Relaxation is nearly always a very, very pleasant experience. So my face starts to feel relaxed, as long as the whole of the body, it does feel pleasant. And hopefully you can perceive that pleasant experience of the whole body being relaxed. If you can, and know the joy of relaxation. That by itself, the perception of the pleasure, the ease of relaxation, takes your relaxation to a deeper level. I feel really good. If there's still some more work to relax your own body, take as much time as you wish. So the whole body is at ease. And then we move to the mind. How peaceful are you? We're now going to focus, be mindful of this quality of mind called peace. Really get to know it. Not just superficially, but deeply. How does peace feel? How do you recognize it? Can you notice, the longer you stay here, the deeper that peace is? Peace is not just one thing. It's a whole spectrum of joyful, deep, delightful peace. Once you know what disturbs peace, and you avoid that, and the peace grows stronger and stronger, which is usually perceived as more powerful and more joyful, like the relaxed body is joyful. The relaxed mind, peaceful mind, is even more blissful. I'm going to be quiet until I finish. getting close now to the end of the meditation period. How do you feel? How deep was the peace? How pleasant was it? And how did it refresh your body, energize it? I will now ring the gong 3 times. Please listen to every ringing of the gong. When the last one vanishes, come out from the meditation. We do have a few questions here. I usually like doing the ones online first. Question, dear Ajahn Brahm, in order to meditate, we have to stop doing and wanting, but we can't ignore the fact that we meditate because we want peace. And we do go to retreat. What is the right understanding here? You are doing some wanting, some arrangement when you start the meditation process. You're going to want to come here. And as I usually, just an approximation, but it's pretty accurate, which I tell the monks and the nuns, your wanting is there when you start to even travel towards a meditation hall. But when you actually sit down to meditate, as soon as your bottom hits the chair or the cushion, that's when you stop the wanting. That's an approximation, but it's not a bad one. You want to actually to get on that cushion, find the space and the time. But once you're sitting down and you've got yourself reasonably relaxed, then the wanting stops. And you find if the wanting stops at that point, you'll find that maybe you may get a little bit tired at the beginning, or a tiny bit restless, but not that much. And what happens? You start to build up the energy of peace. You start to feel the mind is getting more still. It's easier to get into a comfortable posture, and also it's easier to get yourself peaceful. When the peace does start to grow and become one of the main things which you are observing or experiencing in meditation, that perception of peace becomes your path of meditation. And it becomes very pleasant. So pleasant that you just don't want to do anything. It's not that, you know, wanting is restrained or suppressed. The wanting vanishes. Imagine what that's like, sit there and don't want anything in the whole world. Contentment. And that contentment gets very, very strong and very deep. From Bunbury, how can a person break through seemingly impenetrable barriers of childhood trauma and move forward in a life that is self-destructive? Don't quite understand that question, but nevertheless, if you've had some childhood trauma, how you don't kind of break through that, you allow it to disappear and vanish, step by step, stage by stage. And you do that through some courage, but mostly through this beautiful sense of good karma, good kindness. I've mentioned that before in this group here in Perth called Assets. I will just give this simile briefly because I've said this so many times before. Assets is the Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. The people who have been tortured, multiple rapes, beatings, terrible things happen in these countries overseas mostly. And in order to lead them slowly past that trauma, when they feel confident and safe, that's one of the first requirements. If you don't feel safe, it's very hard to let go and actually to get rid of all those barriers so you can see what's happened clearly. And then they were using the opening the door of your heart simile. Just imagine when you're meditating, you feel safe. When are you ready for it? It can't ever be forced. Then you start imagining this double door in the middle of your heart. And it opens up. And inside is that part of you. It's not the whole of your experience. Not the whole of what defines you. Part of it. The part of it which you can deal with, which you feel happy and pleasant with. But then you know that's only a portion of you. And then in the simile of the opening the door of your heart, you're standing there in a nice part of your heart. You look out into the ground and you can view these people who are excluded, stigmatized, afraid, outside, not allowed to come in. And as you look down, you see that's you. When you were a young girl, when you were a young boy, tortured, abused. And then you have the courage, with good encouragement, feeling safe, to imagine a staircase coming down from your heart to the ground and slowly encouraging each one of those people who are connected to you through history. There were you a few months ago or a couple of years ago. You invite them to climb up those stairs and you're waiting at the top, ready to embrace them. No longer will I stigmatize you. No longer will I reject you. You made me who I am. You're part of me. When is that coming together with the huge amounts of courage and kindness? You realize the meaning. And the meaning is that this is where we grow and learn. This is like in that old story of the truckload of shit. Comes in. From that you grow these incredible qualities of kindness, wisdom, compassion. That gives it meaning. So No barrier is impenetrable. Childhood trauma, once you understand its meaning, and it doesn't trouble you anymore, it's inside, you've allowed it to come in, and you become such a better human being. And it's not a barrier anymore, it's part of you. Okay, now meditation question. From Singapore. When I close my eyes, I would see the back of my eyelids. But if I'm still enough, I soon see a black spot in the middle of my vision. It feels like a fracture in my eye consciousness. I find it calming and insightful as it helps me see my consciousness as just eye consciousness. The form world as just empty forms. However, it tends to go away when I pay attention to it. How do I sustain it? Thank you. If you do see a black spot in the middle of my vision, if it doesn't start to look beautiful, then it will go away. What sustains your attention on things? You can't force your attention to stay with something. But when it starts to feel delightful, beautiful, amazing, of course you can't keep your mental attention away from it. That's why I still remember this one gentleman. When he said he could see one of these nimittas, one of these beautiful lights in the mind, I was surprised because he described like the color black as his nimitta. He was a Scottish gentleman. When he said black, is that really a nimitta? But then he described it as the most beautiful black he'd ever seen in his whole life. Gorgeous, like shimmering, you know, beautiful. And because it was, he described it in these terms, which I'd never associated the color black with. So gorgeous and beautiful, the best, most beautiful black he'd ever seen in his life. Then I realized that was a nimitta. So even these dark spots, they can become incredibly beautiful. Once they do become beautiful, again, you can sustain your attention there. You don't do it. It draws you in. So that's one of the reasons why, when I was describing the meditation of being aware of your body, your own body, and then when it gets really relaxed, there is a feeling of delight. And I wanted everybody to experience that delightful feeling, because that keeps your attention there. It doesn't want to go off to think of other things. It's just too enjoyable to be with a body which is now really, really, really relaxed. And then when you go deep into the meditation, you go to peacefulness or to silence, that also becomes so incredibly attractive. All the sounds which grab your ears, you don't go listening to them, they actually make you listen to them. And the most beautiful of those is the silence. And any time in nature, especially over in Australia, it's one of the quietest countries, even like Bodhinyana Monastery or Jhana Grove, it can be so really quiet at night time. Even during the daytime. To me, that's so attractive, it's so beautiful. And so because I find it delightful, my attention can stay with that silence, the beautiful silence, without any effort. It's like a nice place to rest. So if you do see a black spot in the middle of my vision, just see its most beautiful part, and then see if that becomes so delightful that that sort of spot or that image stays. Lastly, from Germany, when there is vitaka vichara, it is always first jhana, or can one be aware of this wobble in the mind in other meditative states before jhana? Many thanks. Okay, that's a technical question. They say that in this first jhana, this first deep meditation, there's this quality called vitakka vichara. Sometimes people interpret that to mean like thought and examination. But I think that those of you who have been meditating with me here for a couple of years know that it means something totally different than that. Thinking is not peaceful. There is silence in the mind. Nothing is actually verbalized. You can't sort of give instructions. You can't say anything to your mind. And I know that sometimes it becomes our habit when we see something beautiful or inspiring or interesting, we try and investigate it with words, trying to put it into these boxes called language. And they resist that. And it disturbs the meditation. I've often advised that when you start to get into deep meditations, don't try and say anything. Don't try and describe it to yourself. Leave it. Leave it, I mean don't interfere with it. In the deep meditations, your memory becomes so strong. You'll be able to recall that experience with no problem at all. And when you record it at the end of the meditations, or even the next day when you talk to a teacher, when you record it with incredible accuracy and ease. So you don't need to analyze it yet. Wait till at the end, or after, then you analyze. But while you're there, be still. And that's one of the reasons why the idea that thought exists in these deep meditations is just, that means you haven't achieved or experienced those deep meditations yet. They have to be silent, peaceful, still. While you're in that first jhana, while you're right in there, the idea of a wobble is it's not sort of thought, it's just the mind is not 100% still, it's 99.9% still. And that difference between 100% stillness and the 99.9%, I just call that a wobble. And the reason is, this is going to the deep meditations, the reason is that because you have this incredible bliss in the mind and the mind holds on to it. Just holding on to it, subtle as that, disturbs it. And so you tend to experience-wise like you're moving away from that bliss. But the bliss is just so powerful. It pulls you straight back in, like immediately after a second. And you stay there for longer, and then move away from it, pulls you in again. That's only because you're letting go. You only can let go with the confidence that you don't need to hold on. When that letting go fades, you stay there in the bliss and doesn't move. And that becomes what's called the second jhana. The vitakka vichara is gone. So that is, if one understands the meaning of that word wobble and vitakka vichara not being thought or verbalization of anything, but just the movement of the mind, a very, very last piece of movement of the mind. When you understand what that means, you realize that that particular wobble is only referring to that first jhana state. Thank you for that nice question. Don't know how many of you understood it, but nevertheless, any questions from the people here? Questions are free. Okay, no questions. I can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And then afterwards, if you need to come up and ask your own personal questions, please come up.